Hey, could you start the clock, Bridget? All right. Good morning. Welcome. my name is Curtis Sahn. I'm with Microsoft Consulting Services, and I'm going to talk to you today about the more modern approach to getting ready to deploy Office 2010. And just so you know, this is the last session, or another way to say it is I am all that's in front of you in the way of you getting food, right? Last session before lunch. So I would appreciate, I probably am going to end up talking and blah, blah, blahing almost the whole time. So if you have any questions, please wait till the end and feel free to come talk to me afterwards. I can unfortunately talk for quite a while about this, so for good or for bad. So this presentation was derived from a workshop that I helped build with our office product team. And we've delivered this workshop, myself and our consulting partners, about 300 times in the past year worldwide. So the stuff we're going to talk about today is conceptual. Here's the right process, or here's a better approach, but this has been tested in production, right? We have been evangelizing this and talking this up to our customers about it. And we got some war stories, and I'll be interjecting some comments about what we've seen, what's worked, what hasn't worked, some pushback that we've gotten. And also, what's important to note is that when we designed the workshop, we wanted to make sure that the concepts aren't just applied to Office 2010. Right now, with Office 15, we're in, what is it, technical preview phase, and public beta or public preview, I'm not sure what it's going to be called, is going to be later this summer. So the concepts that we're talking about today don't expire when Office, when the next version comes around. And that was an important design concept for us, is that what we're going to be talking about today is going to position you to better deploy Office 2010, and you can use the same concepts and approach when deploying Office 15 or I guess 16. All right. There's my clicker. So what we're going to talk about is we're going to take a review of what we see as the traditional approach to getting ready to deploy Office and what we see a lot of customers performing. And then we're going to talk about what's the more modern approach. And we're going to go into more details and dig a little deeper into what that modern approach means. We're going to separate it into pre-deployment activities, post-deployment activities, making sure we're delineating, well, which ones are the right tasks and activities to engage before and after deployment, and talk about when it's appropriate to do proactive testing and fixing and remediation versus reactive testing and fixing and remediation. And we'll talk about, even though the word reactive remediation sounds a little scary, right? I'm going to fix things once I run into a problem. We're going to talk about why, in some cases, that might be a better approach. And throughout this, we're going to talk about tools, right? This isn't a tools discussion. We've got a lot of tools for Office compatibility. And there's a company here on the Tech Expo, Converter Technologies. They've got some great tools. So this isn't a tools discussion about, hey, what tool's the best, how to use the tools. But we are going to talk about, during the parts of the process, when can tools help? When can they get in the way? What are appropriate uses? And what we've seen as some inappropriate uses of tools. So throughout the whole discussion, we're going to interject about when tools are good and bad. All right, so let's talk about what we see the traditional approach is. Basically, the first thing that we see a lot of customers do is start with trying to find everything, right? So when, especially with Office, we see, you know what, we better figure out, well, I want to find all of my documents that are out there, right? It's a traditional first step. And then what you do is you take all that information, and we've got a tool, OMPM, Office Migration Planning Manager, that will help you scan all your documents and so you can inventory everything or the stuff that you want. Then you review all those documents for issues and then criticality or importance to the business. And usually it's done in that order, right? Our OMPM tool is great because it provides red, yellow, green categories of issues, right? And green is good, red's bad, yellow is not so good, not so bad. So it's very easy to conceptualize and say, hey, great. What I'm going to do is find everything, and then I'm going to just focus on red things because that makes a lot of sense. Red is bad. And so that's what we see is the typical first step. Find everything, focus on what's a tool says is bad, and start from there. Then you start testing everything, and then you keep testing. And then you say, you know what? I've done all my red stuff. Let me go down to the yellow stuff. And you keep on testing and testing and testing. And that we see takes a long, long time. So some benefits of that approach is that you can manage your risk better, or you can think you can manage your risk better by getting more data about your current environment. right? There's the, what's the phrase? You can't manage what you can't measure. So the first thing you do is the best way you can prepare, this is the mindset, best way you can prepare for migrating to a new platform or a new environment is to get assess your current state. And how can you do that without a lot of data? So that's what we see that is a big benefit to this approach is you find out, hey, what's my current state? It'll help me prepare to go to the next state. And also, the IT group is pretty much tasked with just keeping things working, keeping the lights on. Right? So, and they have to deliver on those expectations. So I often equate being in IT with you know, cutting the grass. People only tend to notice when you do a bad job. Right? For instance, yesterday, everyone just expects the internet's going to be here. People really notice when the internet's not working. Right? So people just expect that things are going to be working. That's what the IT department has to deliver on. Probably everyone is saying, what are these guys doing? I can't get the internet working. Right, so this expect you got the IT group is responsible for managing the environment, have to deliver on that. So they want to get as much information so that when they get ready to move to a new environment, there's no surprises during the deployment of that new environment or the new platform. Right, and that's the big goal is try and find as much information as possible, test as many things as you can, so that there's no surprises. And also with the volume of stuff that we see with Office, there are a lot of tools that will help you get there. And so we see the traditional approach heavily relies on tools to automate gathering and analyzing a lot of stuff. Some challenges with that approach, though, is lengthy evaluations. The first one, and that's actually the goal of this session, right? So the big benefit of this session, that, or at least my goal, is to help you position you and your companies to deploy Office faster and with lower risk. Right? There's no point in deploying something, you know, twice or three times as fast if you're just going to run into problems. But if you can deploy something faster while keeping your risk low or lowering your risk, then you're saving a lot of time and your management, you know, you're saving a lot of money. And that's the benefit. So, and the goal of creating this workshop that we built with the Office product team was to change that number. What we're seeing is in large companies, 30, 40,000 and up, it takes about 12 to 18 months to get ready to deploy the first seat of Office or almost any platform like IE or Windows, right? 12 to 18 months. And our goal in coming up with this workshop is to cut that number in half, right? And that's the biggest cost we see to an IT group or an organization when migrating to new environments is just preparing for it, getting ready to get ready, right? And so if it takes you a long time just to change environments or to get ready to change environments, what you're doing is you're hindering your business's agility or your company's ability to respond to change in the environment or enact change in the environment. And that leads to a potentially downward spiraling mindset of, it took so long to go to the last version. I just better wait. I'll skip this version. I'll go to the next one. Right? For instance, how many people are currently on Office 2003? All right, so it's about half. How many are on Office 2010 now but migrated from Office 2003? All right, that's about a quarter. So, and that's it's common. I've delivered this workshop personally about 12 times, and all but two customers were coming from Office 2003. One was coming from 2007, one was coming from Office XP. So that's a challenge is if you just stay static and don't ever enact change, you're very resistant to enacting change. And that's another goal of being more agile or more modern in your compatibility approach is to position your company to better respond to change. So that's a big challenge with the traditional approach is it takes so long just to get ready. Also, when you're scanning all your documents and trying to find everything out there, you're treating all your stuff equally. Right? And we see that scanning documents, believe it or not, and finding everything takes probably the most time. Right? And so when you scan everything, you're treating everything equally. And there's no way to generate a return on investment to determine, hey, is it worth it to scan all that stuff? For example, I've been with Microsoft 5 years, and just two weeks ago, I scanned my documents folder and found out I have 1,200 Office documents. Right? One person, 5 years, 1,200 documents. Right? Would it make sense, if I'm upgrading to the next version of Office, would it make sense for me to inventory and scan all 1,200 just to get ready? Oh, if you're listening on the recording, the answer is no. Sorry. For instance, of those 1,200, I found 21 had the word resume in it. 15 were actually my resume. So it's hard to justify trying to evaluate all those documents when you don't know how critical they are, how critical they are to me. Right? One person, 5 years, 1,200 documents. In fact, what we when I go to customers, when we start to estimate or talk about, well, how many documents do you have in your environment, we usually start at 500 documents per user. And depending on your industry, that may, it just goes up. So if you have a 10,000 person company, you can usually start with, okay, you've probably got about 5 million documents. Again, if you're in a financial industry, that may be going up and up and up. Right? So 5 million, I mean, just think about it. 5 million data points. What can you possibly do with 5 million data points? And that's one of the reasons why it takes the evaluations take so long, is that that type of information just freezes people. What do I do with millions of things? And the challenge with using tools in general is that they're not used appropriately. If they're not used for their intended use, they can a lot of people use them to provide direction and guidance. If they're used inappropriately, they can provide misguidance. Right? I want to get to there. Will the tool help me helps me go that way? And if you're using a tool to help, you know, get you to this way, but you're actually heading that way, you're going the wrong direction. Right? So they can provide misguidance. Over-reliance on tools is a big challenge. And I'll be the first to admit that we, Microsoft, help put people in this position, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. And again, the biggest challenge with this approach is that it can be really costly. And that's really the biggest benefit of doing a faster deployment while keeping risk low is the cost savings. All right, so the more modern approach. On the surface, doesn't look much different. The biggest difference, one of the big differences, is the first item, the discovery. Right? It's no longer, we don't consider it inventory. Right? Inventory is figure out, hey, what's out there. Discovery is figure out what is critical to the business. Right? What applications, or in the office terms, what office solutions, right? Documents, add-ins, macros, or documents with macros, interop applications, you know, apps that programmatically interface with Office. What Office solutions does it take to run my business? Those are the ones you want to discover. Right? And the way we're recommending that is collaborate with your business partners, with your business areas. Don't try and find everything. Ask them first. And that, to me, that has been one of the most feedback-generating items that I've said when I present this to customers. Like, what do you mean just go say what does it take to run your business? And that's exactly what we're advocating. We'll talk more in a little bit. And then basically once you discover what's important, then you start to prioritize or to rationalize, well, what do I really need to test, by basing it on, how much does it impact the business? How many users would be out if this isn't working? What's the financial cost or outage, or how much money would I be losing if this application or solution isn't available? That's how you want to focus your testing. And so the goal of discovery and your rationalization is to figure out, well, what do I want to test? And then you do your testing and remediation. Basically, you proactively test and fix those specific office solutions that have been explicitly identified as critical to the business. Right? And then you were advocating that you reactively test everything else as they come up. Right? And that's exactly what help desks are around for. And then once you start deploying, then you can start managing your environment. Right? Tracking if there's any issues. Right? Getting value out of your investment. And we're going to talk about, hey, document conversion is one of those steps that you can get more value out of your investment in Office 2010. And then also, I mean, the biggest benefit of migrating to a new platform, you know, like, hey, why are you even migrating to a new environment? Usually for Office, the answer is I want to take advantage of the productivity gains. I want to make my end users more productive, right? I am going to spend money on buying a new version of Office so that I can make more money for my business. That's the goal of deploying into a new environment, is to be more productive. And that's what we want to get to, is speeding up that process so that you can make more money for your company. All right, so what does that still look like? Basically, this is just a visual view of the previous slide. You end up starting with your project team, and you say, hey, let's work with each different functional area, and go up to them and ask them and say, hey, what does it take to run your business? What office solutions are critical to you? Right? And you may need to have that conversation with every different department or business functional area, or however you segregate your business users. You may need, depending on the size of your environment, you may have that discussion 5 times, 20 times, 25 times. But trust me, that is a lot more efficient than trying to find everything and then sort through that data. And once you generate all those applications, you get a list of, okay, let's it's like you're whitelisting your critical solutions. Then you're identifying which ones are important to the business. And then you start testing. You proactively test only the things that have been specifically identified. And ideally, what you're going to do after that discovery and your testing, you're going to hopefully create some type of knowledge base, and you're going to be able to track those critical solutions better. Right? Discovery is something that you don't want to do every time, ideally, when you're migrating to a new environment or to a new platform. The goal of discovery is to figure out, hey, what's critical to me? What do I need to test? So that when you, if you go to a newer version of Office, next year, 2 years, 3 years, 10 years, you don't have to do that discovery effort again or as much. So after you've tested your critical stuff, then you start deploying. And it's one of our biggest messages. Hey, just go. What we're finding, especially with documents, there is about a 2 to 3% failure rate for Office solutions, especially documents that were created in previous versions of Office, Office 2003 and earlier, and using them in Office 2010, right? 2 or 3% failure rate. Or another way, a more positive way to look at it, is about a 97% success rate in making sure all your previous stuff works in Office 2010. Right? And one thing to think about is, hey, do I have a 97% success rate now? And that's why we're advocating test only the critical stuff first, because you don't need to find and test everything. And that's what we're advocating is after you deploy, then you start, when the users start using their applications, their documents, if they run into issues, and you're going to run into issues with any platform migration, not just it doesn't work, but hey, where did my print button go? Right? Especially if you're coming from 2003, the ribbon can be scary, or the ribbon can be different, and different enough that it may generate help desk calls. So you need to help. You need to position your help desk to handle that potential influx of help desk calls. Right? Even though no matter how much you test and how much you prepare, you're going to run into issues afterwards. And you need to prepare for that scenario. So that's why we're advocating leveraging your help desk. It's much more cost effective, not only from an IT perspective, also from a business perspective, to make you more productive. Reactively test everything else except for the stuff that's been specifically identified as critical. All right, then after your deployment, then you can talk about, well, how am I going to get more value out of my investment? Now that I've gone to Office 2010, what can I do with it? How is it going to benefit me? One thing is to think about, hey, is document conversion, bulk document conversion, something I want to engage in? And I'm going to stress that is an optional post-deployment task. Right? The goal of deploying Office 2010 is not to convert all your stuff. The goal is to get your users more productive. Right? Compatibility mode in Office 2010 is designed to open and run all of your old stuff. Right, and that's how we get that 97, 98% success rate. So we have got great tools. OMPM is a great tool for estimating and figuring out, well, what's my risk if I convert my documents to the new file format? Then you can estimate, well, listen, how much money am I going to save? How much storage savings can I realize? And you can generate a return on investment to say, if I engage in a document conversion project, I can save the business this much money, or I can save this much storage. And then you can determine, hey, is it really worth it? So don't just convert because you can. Determine, hey, is it really worth my time, my money? So one thing we haven't talked about, sorry. And then, yeah, that's how we're advocating making sure your focus, your pre-deployment tasks are only activities and tasks that are deployment enablers, things that are on the critical path to getting Office out the door or to helping you migrate to the new environment. Your post-deployment tasks are environment optimization tasks. Ones that you can get more value out of your investment, right? So one thing we haven't mentioned is, okay, well, when do I scan my documents for issues, right? That's a typical first step for a lot of customers when getting ready to migrate Office. We are advocating that is a post-deployment step, right? Not a pre-deployment step. That's not the first thing you should do. Why? Our tool set, OMPM, will scan for document conversion issues, right? So it helps answer the question, what's my risk if I convert my doc, my XLS, my PPT files to the latest file format, the OpenXML file format? It does not help answer the question, what's my risk if I use this file or these 1,000 files or these million files in Office 2010? Which is what a lot of people want to use it for, to figure out, hey, I want to figure out what's going to be my risk when I migrate. I better run a tool to figure that out. Right? The OMPM tool does not help get you there. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more as well. All right, so let's dig a little deeper into, okay, well, what are those pre-deployment activities? Or what do you need to do before you deploy? Or what do you got to do proactively? First thing is discovery, right? Again, we're not calling it inventory. We don't want to find, the inventory is got big circle, right? In a Venn diagram, it's the big circle. Here's what I have, right? And my arms aren't even big enough for a large company to figure out. Here's what I have. Here's all my volume of stuff. That's what inventory is. And the traditional method is a scan and find all of them. And then you cross off the ones that don't meet whatever criteria you have. And if you're using something like OMPM to scan all your documents, usually the criteria are those severity, the categories of document conversion issues. Right? And that could be the wrong criteria. So basically, in the goal of discover or inventory and rationalization is to get from that big circle of what I have to the small circle of what I need. That's where a lot of customers start. Right? Let me find out my current state, and I'll just filter out everything so I get to my what I really need to worry about. Right? And that'll help me manage my next platform migration, because now I've figured out I've gone from what I have to what I need. The challenge, though, especially with Office, and I think I mentioned it, is the volume of stuff, right? So that the goal is to get to, well, what do I need? But in the Office terms, we can be talking about millions of data points. So the what I need circle of stuff is so much smaller than the what I have circle of stuff that the process of inventory and then rationalization, you know, finding out what I have to get to what I need is very inefficient and very costly. So don't recommend that at all. So what we are advocating, the more modern method, start with the end users. And say, hey, listen, we need to figure out what Office solutions it takes to run your business. The biggest reason is, in general, Office solutions aren't managed by the IT group. Right? In a lot of companies, you have, for locally installed applications, they're managed, they're deployed by the IT group. Typically not so for Office. Right? One of the biggest benefits and frustrations of Office solutions is that anyone can build them. Right? And they can grow organically in your environment, sometimes like a weed. Or they can actually be, and a nicer way to say it is they can really help your business. But that's a big challenge, right? IT generally has very little insight into what Office solutions are being used. So to try and find them by saying, let's find everything, and I'll just find things with macros. That doesn't get to the point of, well, what's really critical to the business. And that's why we're advocating a discovery process to figure out what's important, not inventory. And the goal of discovery is, again, to figure out, what do I care about? What's important to me? Right? So don't start with a big circle of what do I have just to get to that little tiny circle of what I need. Start asking the end users directly. It's a user-centric approach to figure out, hey, what is really important? Because the goal of discovery in general is to feed your test plan. Right? You want to discover what's important, and if you're migrating to the new version, you want to test those things. If there are things that run your business that if they're not working, you're going to be out lots and lots of money. Or if you're in the IT side, you're going to be out of job. Right? Those are the things you want to test. And that's the overall goal of discovery, is that it leads into testing. It directly determines what do I need to test. So the challenge with saying, well, let's only focus on critical things, right? And that can be a very uncomfortable conversation. If I go up to a business partner and say, hey, listen, I'm in IT. You tell me what Office solutions it takes to run the business. That can be very, at first, that can be, hard to accept, hard to hear, and actually hard to say. So one of the things is to figure out, well, what does critical really mean? Right? What is a critical document, or what is a critical solution? From an IT perspective, what you can do is draw a couple lines in the sand and say, there are things that absolutely have to be working no matter what. Those are my critical things. Those are things I want to make sure I test. Right? Things that actually, generate money for the business. Those are the things I need to test beforehand. Then there are things that, hey, if they aren't working or I can't figure them out, I'll call the help desk. Right? And again, that's what help desks are positioned for. My very first IT job in 1990 was on a help desk. The newspaper ad, the requirements were you must know Excel and networking for a help desk. Right? And I didn't know anything about networking at the time. But regardless, help desks are uniquely positioned in IT groups to handle Office issues. Right? The desktop support, your engineers, your architects, the server support, they really don't deal in Office. Anyway, so reactively test and fix things that that aren't just that important. And then there are lots of things, probably most things, that you're never, ever, 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 ever going to care about. Why would you even spend your time trying to inventory those? My 21 copies of the resume on my My Documents folder. One copy may have been important the day before I tried to apply for a job. Maybe not so important that I need to, to fix it in case I wanted to upgrade to a new environment, but 15 of them couldn't be that important. So the first time I went to a customer, an insurance company in the States, in Connecticut, some guy looked at me and he was either a project manager representing one of the businesses or a development manager, I can't remember. And he said to me, he goes, listen, we're in business, right? All the stuff we create is critical. We don't have people that create non-critical stuff, right? That just doesn't make business sense. And the guy next to him goes, said, yeah, we got rid of those people last year and the last year's downsizing. Good stuff. But his point was valid, right? He said, when you're saying, tell me what's critical, you're subtly saying, let's find out all the stuff that you have that's not important. No one wants to hear that. So the challenge there is to figure out, okay, well, what does critical really mean? Right? And he's right. Maybe the stuff he created yesterday was critical. Maybe the stuff he created today was critical. What if he created something 5 years ago and it's still on the network? Everything has a lifespan. So from a business perspective, well, what really makes it critical? And really the answer is it worth it? Is it worth your time and money to actually test it? Right? So my coworker, Chris Jackson, who did a session yesterday on App Compat in general, he has this on his blog, appcompatguy.com. Basically, it is worth it to test it if the cost of failure of an app or a solution times the probability of failure is greater than the cost of testing. Otherwise, don't even bother testing. Doesn't make sense. And a great example he gives on his blog site is if I have a get-out-of-traffic-court-free card that I'm willing to sell you for 100 euros, would you buy it to get out of a 50-euro traffic or speeding ticket? I would love to sell that to you, but it really doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to avoid the risk of going to traffic court than to actually pay the fine and move on. Another example I think he said or someone else said was, does it make sense to buy a $60 or 60-euro insurance policy on a 50-euro bill? Right? I said that to a customer 2 weeks ago, and they said, hey, it's kind of like a reverse Groupon. And I thought that was a great example. I told her I was going to steal that. So this is a great way to determine from the business, okay, well, what do I mean by critical? Not that your stuff that you've created isn't or wasn't important, but is it worth it to test? Now, an easy way to shortcut this is to say, hey, when we talk about what's on critical, what's in your disaster recovery plan? Right? If you've got office solutions that aren't part of your disaster recovery plan, how can you justify saying they're really critical? Right? If your main site becomes unavailable for whatever reason, and your end users need to work from home or a different location, what's in your business continuity plan or disaster recovery plan? What things have to be there when they go to that new location? That is the best place to start to figure out, well, what's really critical. And if your office solutions aren't on there, then either they really aren't that critical or they should be. And then you can start having a conversation of, well, here's what we mean by critical. Not that you created some stuff that's not really important, but is it worth it to test? Do you need to run? Do you need the solution today or tomorrow to run your business? All right. So then we're talking about tools during discovery and the rationalization part. When are tools appropriate? Right. So the goal of using any tool in general for discovery is to automate the process of getting to here's what I need. Right. And using OMPM, a lot of people start with here's what I have, and let me filter out here's what I need. But the goal of any tool in discovery is to figure out what I need. The risk in using any tool is that, again, your goal of discovery is to figure out, well, what do I need to test? What's really critical? If you're using a tool, you're using technical criteria to help derive business value. Right? So no tool can tell you, this document is very important. This document has a 200-line macro. Oh, I must test it. Well, just because that macro exists, does that mean it's important to the business? No tool can tell you this is important. That's the challenge. If you use any tool, and I'm not saying using tools is bad in general, but if you use any tool to help derive business criticality, you're adding some degrees of separation between what the tool provides or what the filtering criteria you're using and actual business value. And depending on what criteria you're using, you could introduce a lot of false positives or false negatives when you're doing your discovery and rationalization. And what I mean by false positives, if you're using the criteria of, let me find out everything that's been accessed in the past year as your criteria, that's what I'm going to start with. Well, you're going to get a lot of false positives. You're going to find a lot of things that really aren't that important, and you're going to waste a lot of testing cycles. That's very expensive. Then there's false negatives. What if I say, let me find everything that's only been used in the past week? That's obviously the most critical stuff because people have used it this week. Then you run the risk of false negatives or missing things that really are important that just didn't meet your filtering criteria. And that's using any technical criteria, any criteria other than, is this important to the business? Any tool you use introduces those risks. So you need to weigh against those risks against, well, how much is the tool helping me? So the recommendation is, if you're going to use a tool, make sure that technical criteria you're using closely aligns with business value. One example is usage. How much is this solution being used? That's a great way to derive business value, right? If this is if you have a 5,000-person company and 3,000 people have used the solution this week, or last week, or in the past 3 months, that's a great way to say, hey, this must be important. Not perfect, but it's really, really, really close. Now, if you use bad criteria, it's the same as chance or flipping a coin, right? If you're using the wrong criteria to help using your rationalization point, then you're going down the wrong direction. A silly example of that is ice cream. So I go to the store to get my wife some ice cream. She goes, hey, honey, go get me ice cream. I'm like, okay, no problem. So I go to a new store. I've never been there before. It's got 50 flavors. And I get in there, and I'm overwhelmed. Absolutely. I said, I can't figure this out. So, hey, I'm a smart guy. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to filter that out to make a more manageable result set that I can actually pick something for my wife. So being such a super smart guy, I assign a number, 1 through 50, to all the different flavors of ice cream, right? Because that's obviously the right thing to do. And then I say, you know what? I am going to eliminate all of ice cream flavors that have a number assigned to it that are not prime numbers. Poof! Look what I just did. I just reduced my result set by 70%. Thank you. Thank you. That was just great. But so right now I have 14, I think, flavors to choose from. Great. Now I can pick something for my wife. It's a lot easier. So the question remains is, how much closer am I to figuring out what my wife wants? It would make a lot more sense if I said, hey, honey, if I call her, what flavor do you want? I'm at the store now. What do you want? Whoops, I'm going backwards. It would make a lot more sense to ask her. And again, a very silly criteria, but the point is if you're using the wrong criteria, it's the same as just picking arbitrary criteria. Like saying, I'm going to find all my documents, and I'm only going to test the ones that start with the letters E through G. That's my criteria. You may have reduced your testing needs by 90%. But how much closer are you to figuring out, hey, what's really critical, or how closer are you to preparing for migrating to the new environment? All right, so some recommendations about tools during discovery is that we have a couple of them. OEAT, the Office Environment Assessment Tool, is great for discovering add-ins and interop apps. And add-ins are pieces of code or functionality that extend the functionality of Office. Interop apps are apps that programmatically interface with Office. My favorite interop app, and actually they're here today, is Snagit by TechSmith. They're also in the expo. That is an app that takes screenshots, nice little screen effects, and you can programmatically, you can take a screenshot and send it right to a Word document or an Outlook email. It's pretty cool. Anyway, so OEAT will help discover add-ins and interop apps, and it uses as its criteria usage for interop apps. It'll actually say, well, what apps have been used most recently? That's a great way to help derive business value. It's not perfect, and you can't just say, I'm going to run a tool, and this outputs my list. You need to actually then take that list of here's what I've discovered and validate that with the business. For add-ins, it actually uses the criteria of installation count. Right? So again, I have a 5,000-user environment, and I have discovered that this one add-in is installed on 4,000 of them. Does that necessarily mean it's important? Maybe, and that's a good place to start. But that could be because that add-in was installed as part of the previous version of Office, which was installed as part of your XP image, and it's just always there. So although installation count is one pretty good criteria you can use, it's definitely not the end result, right? So you can use the tool to help identify add-ins and interop apps, and it's going to use pretty good criteria. OMPM, please do not use it for discovery. It has its appropriate uses. It is a great tool for what it's designed for. It is not a great tool for discovery or to figure out, hey, what do I need? And the reason being, I think I mentioned this, is OMPM finds document conversion issues, right? So it helps answer the question of, oh, what's my risk if I convert this document to the latest file format? It does not answer the question, what's my risk if I use this in Office 2010, right? So it leads to drawing the wrong conclusions. Now, there are some cases, and we're going to talk about them in a second, that OMPM can be okay, and this is based on some customer feedback we got about this process. First, I want to talk about OEAT, or the good tool. So again, it's a discovery tool for add-ins and interop apps. And in order to use it, you need to run it on, it's downloadable for free, downloads.microsoft.com. And you run it on your endpoints. Do not run it on, if you have a 10,000 person environment or computer environment, don't run it on all 10,000. Take a representative sample. And then you need to run it under the user's context. The reason being is most add-ins are registered in per user mode. Right? So if you run it under the system context, you're going to miss a lot of stuff. Right? You're going to, it'll result in false negatives. If you want to scan for interop apps, you need admin rights. Because what, when you're scanning for interop apps, what it does is it sets security on certain registry keys to detect what applications are using those, and that's how it determines, am I programmatically interfacing with Office? However, you can get around the admin right requirement if you set up auditing ahead of time, like via group policy. So the requirement is, if you want to detect add-ins and interop apps, it has to be done under the user's context, right? Because you want to scan what's going on for that user. Again, it determines the installation count of add-ins, not the usage, but it does determine usage of your interop apps, which, again, is a great way to help derive business value. And again, a starting point only, not the end-all. It's not the solution. So, and what we're recommending is if you want to use it to identify your test users, right? And that's OEAT, not only can it discover important add-ins and interop apps, it can take it a step further, right? The goal of discovery is to figure out, what do I need to test? Well, with OEAT, you can take that one step further and figure out, well, who's going to test? Right? So this is a simple 5, 6, 7-step process. There's a wizard, helps you create a configuration file that says, how am I going to scan? Where am I going to write my results to? It creates an XML file per computer that it executes on. And then you can compile the results into a very easy-to-consume Excel spreadsheet sorted by installation count and usage. So automatically, you can take a look at, hey, what's the most used or what's the most installed things in my environment? And you can then present that to your business and say, hey, listen, instead of asking what are my interop apps and add-ins that are out there, you can say, listen, here's what we found. Let's figure out which one's important. That's a pretty good use for the tool instead of OMPM, because if you say, here's what I found, you may be giving them a stack of papers this big for your millions and millions of stuff. It's horrible. And then you can identify what the OEAT will do is you can identify, well, which users and computers have those important add-ins and apps. And then you can figure out, okay, well, now I know who can test. So you can take it one step further and just figuring out what needs to be tested. You can figure out who should test. Let's go back to OMPM a little bit. So for discovery person, basically what the tool is, it's a tool set, right? OMPM, Office Migration Planning Manager, is a set of tools that allows you to scan, analyze, filter, and convert documents. Right? The end goal of using the tool is to figure out what documents can be converted. Right? And that's what identifies potential document conversion issues. There are about 30 checks that it does for in Word, Excel, and PowerPoint documents. I think 27 or 28 of them have to do only with document conversion, have nothing to do with will it work. Right? So it is very, very, very little use for actually will it work in Office 2010. The biggest tangible benefit is the Office File Converter tool, the OFC. Then you can do a bulk conversion of your documents, and you can take advantage of the storage savings. We'll talk about that more in a later as well. The most common misuses for OMPM is that people use it as an inventory tool, right? Let me scan my environment to find out what I have. And they also use it as a testing tool. Well, let me just review the data to figure out, will it work, right? If it's red, obviously it's bad. So it's not going to work. So worked at a customer, also insurance, the same insurance company in the States, in Connecticut. And as I walked in, a woman, she was the IT project manager for the Office rollout. She said to me, hey, listen, I hope you talk about OMPM while you're here, because I installed it, I ran it on my home drive, I found 60 red documents, I opened them all up and they're fine. What am I doing wrong? And if it wasn't so inappropriate, I would have given her a big hug, because I'm like, that's exactly the point I'm going to get to later today. So, and it was, she thought she was doing something wrong because she wanted to figure out what's my risk of all my documents, right? And that's a pretty broad statement. And she was trying to figure out what's not going to work, and OMPM doesn't help there. So when I talk to customers and say, listen, you know, go ask the business and say what is important. People say, listen, I just can't do that. I can't go to them and say, tell me what, I'll look like an idiot. So there, again, we talked about how OEAT, you can use that to generate data for add-ins and interop apps, but documents are your biggest data point or your biggest Office solution or your biggest volume of Office solutions that companies are going to have. So one thing you can do is you can tune OMPM to scan it for only files that have been used in the last 2 or 3 weeks. That's going to produce a much smaller subset. And then you can say, hey, listen, here's some data about what's been used recently. So using the technical criteria of have I used it recently to help derive business value. Pretty good, not great, but pretty good. Again, that can lead to false negatives because you're only scanning for like 2 or 3 weeks worth of data. If you tune it for longer than that, like someone said, great, I'll do that and scan for the last 13 months of data. Come on. And that generates a lot of false positives because you're going to identify so much stuff. Another thing you can use it for is once you've identified your critical documents, you can scan just those and provide additional data about that. The thing with OMPM and why it gets people into trouble is it provides data that you can't otherwise get, which is great. Another problem, in my opinion, this is why Microsoft, I think, we contributed to this problem. OMPM, used for document conversion, has the words, Office Migration Planning Manager, has the words planning and migration in the title. So obviously you need to use it for planning your migration, right? No. So we created a tool that has the bad name that I think put a lot of people into problems. Now, another thing you can do is this: when you scan your critical files, you're getting data, again, that you otherwise couldn't get. Now, there may not be much value in it other than the comfort level or the reassurance it provides by saying, listen, I've identified critical things, and now I've got more data about those critical things. It provides that reassurance. A lot of times, there is an emotional need to run a tool to get data that would take you a long time or you couldn't otherwise get. Now, lastly, if you're looking to just figure out, hey, what's been used recently, heck, use Xcopy. Right? Xcopy has what? 20, 30, 40, 50 switches? But you can do the same thing. If you just want to find out what files have been used recently, you can use command line switches and use Xcopy. It executes 50 times faster than using OMPM to get that same data. All right, so after discovery, that feeds right into testing, right? And there are basically three types of testings you want to do prior to deployment. Well, only three types of testing in general. There's automated testing or using a tool to help test, hey, will it work? And again, we've talked about that. Really doesn't exist in the office space. People would like it to exist, but OMPM is not the tool for that. If you're going to use a tool, make sure you're using a tool that will help you get to the answer to the question of, will this work in my next environment? Then there's smoke testing. And again, automated testing and smoke testing are done by the IT group in general. Smoke testing is where you just install, launch the solution, and maybe poke around. Now, the goal of smoke testing, and really there's not much value you can get out of smoke testing. You can uncover obvious issues, and that's going to help you when you're partnering with your end users or your business areas. Because the only unequivocal way to determine does a solution work is to do user testing, end user testing. Right? So if you do smoke testing, those same documents, those same solutions, you may uncover things that are obvious. And it's going to help demonstrate to the business areas that you're partnering with them. Right? You're not just saying, hey, you've got 500 important documents. Yep, go test. Right? That just sounds like you're throwing the bomb over their side. And that's not very partnering-like. If you're doing smoke testing, you're demonstrating and saying, hey, listen, I'm working with you. You may find out, hey, I installed and launched this solution, and when I hit the print button, I got an error. So during your user testing, you may want to check that out. But again, user testing is the only test that can tell you, does something work? Right? No tool will answer the question, does my stuff work? So that's why user testing is so important, is because the reason why you want to do testing is to say, hey, is it compatible in my new environment? Right? Is it compliant? And what does compatibility mean? Basically, if your stuff works, right? So you want to make sure that you can get in the highlighted text there. You need to make sure you can get your job done using that solution, right? A tool may say you've got 10 issues. You've got 5 red things. If you can use the document, so what? If you have a ton of bugs in your software, but you can still get your job done, so what? For instance, what was that silly example I gave? Oh, you hit the print button and you get an error. Well, what if you're using an application or a solution that printing is not part of your function, not part of your job? If that's not what we use that solution for, then is printing or is an error with printing a deployment blocking bug? And probably not. I would hopefully say not. If you still get your job done, If it doesn't involve printing, that's a so what bug. Maybe you want to fix that in a later release, but that's not blocking your deployment. And it may be really easy to fix, but if you're talking in scale, hundreds, thousands of solutions, that may not be good, because the only way you can prove something is compatible is to do your work. Right? No tool can answer that question 100% of the time. There are some tools in other environments and platforms that can get close, but no tool will tell you unequivocally, my stuff works. And the only people who know how to do your work is the people who do the work. That's why important user acceptance testing is so important. And then the last thing, hey, if everything else is broken, right? Printing doesn't work in my solution, but that I don't need it to do my work. Do you care? And most importantly, can you afford to? Right? Can you afford to spend the half an hour, the day, 2 days fixing that bug if it doesn't add any business value, if that operation is going to have to be executed, you know, dozens or hundreds of times? And that's why end-user testing is so important. And for example, let's take Office 2010 as an example. What, it was released 2010, what, May or June 2010? And since then, we've released hot fixes, cumulative updates, and a service pack. Those all have fixed hundreds of bugs. Well, how many of those bugs prevented you from getting your job done? There may be one or two or three of you in here that said, oh, there was a specific bug that prevented me from getting my job done. But Office 2010 was released, apparently, and we found this out afterwards, with hundreds of bugs that have been fixed. And I'm sure there are still dozens, hundreds of bugs in Office 2010 with SP1. But the question is, can you get your job done? Right? So we have released a statement that says Office 2010 is supported, it's compatible on Windows 7. But that's not an ongoing support statement that means this will never, ever, ever have any bugs in the future, ever. No one can make that statement. It's mathematically impossible. So that's what you got to figure out. Well, what does compatibility really mean? And that's why end-user testing is the only thing that can really uncover that. So what the IT group can do, and again, the challenge with end-user testing is that it has to be done by the end users. Or the application or solution owners need to designate a tester, or maybe they're going to be the ones who are doing testing it. So what can the IT group do to help that? Basically, they can provision a user acceptance testing environment. They can create an environment that will really facilitate the end user's testing. A virtual environment is great for this, right? Virtualization technology on the desktop and server side has really matured in the last 15 years. And it's very easy to say, hey, listen, come over to my machine. I've got a virtual machine. And when you're done testing, let me know. Bloop, bloop. All of a sudden, that machine is reprovisioned, and now it can be used for another testing case. But that's on a small scale, right? So if you create a user, a virtual UAT environment, it's really easy to provision and reprovision that. So the same virtual computer can be used for dozens or hundreds of tests by dozens or hundreds of different people, potentially. But for if you have a large environment, just saying, hey, come over to my desk and log on may not be too efficient. If you create some type of centrally hosted model, then you provide that scale and that reach to get out to other areas where you can't just say, hey, come on over to my desk, because that person you're talking to may be in another country. And that's where a hosted solution for a VDI solution, for instance, that closely mimics your production environment or is in production, is a great way to facilitate UAT testing. And that's two of the goals of UAT testing, is make sure your testing environment is as production-like as possible. Right? It is a very uncomfortable conversation to have. Well, why did it work in test, but it failed in production? That's uncomfortable because that's a question where someone's looking to point their finger at someone. It's not my fault. It's the whoever created the test environment's fault. Right? You don't want to be in that situation. And if you're doing test in a non-production-like environment, it really can be non-valid. So that's what you want to do. If you have an environment, maybe a separate domain, that is as production-like as possible, has the same group policy settings, the same back-end requirements. You can get to the internet. You can get to whatever, like SQL data sources or back-end data sources. It's managed similarly. Then you can use that environment. Or if you have, for instance, if you want to create your testing environment in your production domain, for instance, create a separate OU, that your UAT machines are in that OU. They can be managed separately. Make sure they can be provisioned and only managed by a UAT support or coordination team. And the other goal is to make it easy to test. The biggest challenge with UAT is getting people to UAT, right? I don't have time to test. I got work to do. and I don't know if that sounds like what your end users, but that's I've heard that a lot. So prior to joining Microsoft, years ago, I ran a Windows installer packaging team for a large insurance company. And everything that we created always ended up being tested. We wouldn't accept any packaging request unless it had an application owner and a test user. As we got a request, you had to identify who's going to test it. So I don't have time to test it. All right, well, we don't have time to put it in your production environment. How are you going to validate who works it? I mean, the IT group can't say, this application works. You can get your job done because I said so. If I don't know how to use that app, it doesn't make any sense. But anyway, removing testing barriers is really important because that's getting people to test is really difficult. So if you can send them an email that says, click here, and it's automatically going to open a remote desktop session that goes to a centrally hosted machine. All they got to do is click a button, and they can log on. That's great. You can make it a SharePoint portal where they can just select from a group of testing machines. Click here, and it's going to automatically provision, maybe, and then connect to a UAT machine. I worked with a customer just a month ago who said, we started talking about testing, and they said, hey, we got it covered. We have, there were about 15 or 17,000 end users, I can't remember. They had about 40 to 45 branches. But they said, hey, we're preparing. We've created one or two kiosk machines in every branch that has Windows 7 plus Office 2010. And we advertised, you want to get used to the new environment, you want to test your stuff, just walk right over to those machines. I said, hey, that's a great idea. But if you were to say, listen, I need you to test something, can you walk down there and go test on that machine? Yeah, I'll do it later today. Right? That's really easy to ignore. But if you can just say, listen, click here, it's going to automatically bring you to some type of portal or automatically launch a remote desktop session, that's a lot easier, a lot harder to ignore because there's no impact to the end user's computer, and it's a lot easier for them to test. So that's one thing the IT group can do is make sure your UAT environment is as easy to manage as possible. Oh, before I go there, in fact, one more story. A financial customer in Switzerland and Connecticut, 90,000 people. I had coworkers of mine who were working there to help roll out Office for them. And they had a really hard time engaging the business to say, listen. They tried to say, listen, tell us what's important because 90,000 users, financial company, we're talking about well over 100 million documents. Said, we can't scan for all that, so we need your help. Business wouldn't help them. Said, no, we're too busy. We make money for the company. You cost money for the company, so you go figure it out. That wasn't getting anywhere. So they said, okay, we'll try and do scans. And they had a hard time trying to scan their central file locations because they found over 134 central locations. So they took months and months to engage the business, months and months to try and do scans, and it just wasn't working. So what they did, they had the infrastructure for this. They had an existing Citrix environment. So what they did is they created 2,000 Citrix sessions that mimicked their production environment, Windows 7 and Office 2010. And so what they did is they said, okay, for example, they're going to go to Business Unit X. You've got 500 people in your business, and it's now June 27th. Your rollout date for the new environment is July, August, September, October 27th. Well, you have 50 UAT machines that we're allocating. Here are 50 Citrix sessions. Go test all your stuff. You have your rollout date for the new environment is October 27th. You've got 4 months to test all your stuff. That worked. That was a self-service model of testing. They actually they said, you know what, forget about discovery and inventory. That's not working. They went right to testing. Now, what it ended up doing was it ended up doing just-in-time discovery because the users had 4 months to find all their stuff, and they had that same conversation. You know, in a large company, they had to do phased rollouts. So Business Unit X would start in October. Business Unit Y would start in November. So they would allocate a certain number of Citrix sessions to each different business unit and say, test your own stuff. And that would empower the business units to figure out, okay, well, what do I want to test? And they follow that up with a process. In case you run into problems, here's the escalation path. Right? So it wasn't just saying, you know, you go do it. They were actually partnering with the business to say, listen, we're empowering you, or forcing you, to find and test all your stuff. Come to us if you have problems. Here's the escalation path. Here's how we're going to do remediation just in case. That worked for them. Discovery didn't work, but the providing a test environment and making it all self-service really worked. All right, so that's pre-deployment, right? That's proactive testing, all your pre-deployment activities. The next step is to actually do the deployment, and there's a session tomorrow about deployment. I'll show you at the end if you're interested in that. And now we're going to talk about, okay, what about reactive remediation, reactive testing, or positioning yourself to reactively handle issues reactively or as they come up? Or what can you do to position yourself for post-deployment activities? This is also stuff that we're going to do after deployment, and how do you prepare for post-deployment. Most important thing I can do and recommend is get a safety net in place. Right? So for in the office space, app virtualization is a great means to create a virtualized package of Office 2003, for example, and have that prepared. Stick it in your back pocket. Right? So then as you migrate to the new environment, if there are any problems that come up, you have that mitigation solution. Hey, my thing's not working in the new environment. And if the help desk can't resolve it on first call, you can provision them the legacy environment. And that does two things. First, it gets them productive immediately, right? And it won't halt your rollout, which can be really important. But also it allows if you need to remediate that solution, if it's code that needs to be upgraded, that can be done on a lowered or a more normal priority rather than treating it as a fire drill or it's got to be the number one priority thing we worry about, right? Because managing via fire drills is really difficult to do. So if you can get that mitigation solution, that virtual package available, you can say, hey, listen, we're going to give you this virtual copy of Office 2003 for 30 days. Right? And that's going to help manage the transition. Right? You're going to have that safety net in place. Deploying Office or deploying a new platform with the old platform as a backup really makes your end users feel comfortable. Because then you can say, listen, we're going to be changing environments. Most of your stuff is going to work. We've tested a lot of important things. We've done our due diligence. We're confident a lot of things are going to work. If there's any problems, here's how we're going to handle it. Here's how we're going to get you up and running immediately. So that would be, so app virtualization is a great a great solution to help provide a mitigation or a safety net to your customers. And also to prepare for reactive remediation, obviously get your help desk ready. Make sure they are the first or one of the first people in your pilot. Make sure that they can, there's these interactive guides which help provide a list of, or it's a pretty neat Silverlight application that shows you where Office 2003 menu and toolbar commands were and where they are now in Office 2010. Get your help desk to use those, then they can walk people over the phone. Hey, where did my print button go? Or how do I do a mail merge? The ribbon stinks, I don't like it. Whatever. They can actually walk end users over the phone using these interactive guides. So position your help desk to handle those types of calls. You may need to augment them with staff, with contractors. I work with a healthcare company in Minnesota, in the States. And we started talking about help. They said, we got that covered. I'm like, what do you mean? 90,000 people. For the Office and Windows rollout, they hired 22 or 23 contractors, 16 level 1, 6 level 2, and they were just interviewing for one level 3. This was January. And they said, we're only hiring for the duration of the rollout. That's it. So contractors as a way to augment your staff is great because they can be rolled off as soon as the project is over. Another neat thing you can do is if you can position your help desk, and this really depends on change control or how software distribution is done in your environment, to deploy that mitigation, that virtual package while they're on the phone, if you can resolve customers' problems on first call in case there are solutions that just won't work in the new version of Office, and again, Office 2010, 2010, 15, 16, whatever new versions come around, that can be really empowering to the help desk, and you can get your users productive immediately. I mean, imagine saying, listen, we can't roll out because there's going to be problems. Well, what if I can get you up and running in a half an hour? Is that acceptable? Oh, yeah, well, that's okay. And that may answer 90-95% of the cases. Things that you say, no, it's not acceptable. There's no way I can have any downtime. Well, that's the stuff you test proactively. Another thing you can do with the interactive guides is actually deploy them with Office. Right? So the interactive guides are any other MSI package, and you can actually use the Office customization tool to deploy one or more interactive guides with Office 2010. So what I've done with customers is I've actually customized, created a transform for those interactive guides, and redirected the shortcut so that's in the Start Menu, Programs, Microsoft Office, Help folder. So when they get Office 2010, they get the interactive guides in their Help folder, which we just created. So again, it provides a self-help means or self-service means of help. They call the help desk the first time. I don't like the ribbon. Where did all my stuff go? Help desk can walk them through on the phone, or then they can say, did you know you can figure this out yourself? Check out these interactive guides. That's one pretty neat strategy. All right, document conversion. This is again, optional post-deployment step. Your office deployment project should not include conversion in it. That is, should be a totally separate project that you can determine, hey, really, is it worth it after you deploy. The main benefits for conversion, well, let me look at the second one first. You can leverage new features, right? So you can leverage SmartArt, SparkLines, some of the newer features in all your older stuff. But it doesn't really make much business sense to convert all your old stuff just to take advantage of new features, right? If you're talking about millions of documents, just to take advantage of new features, you're probably not going to use those millions of documents in the future. You're going to use a very small subset. So it makes a lot more sense to convert them, you know, in an ad hoc method, just in time, by hitting save as. If you want to use the new features, great, convert that document on the fly. So using, leveraging new features is not, in my opinion, much of a business driver to do any type of bulk document conversion. The biggest driver is the storage savings. Our public documentation says you can save up to 75% using the new file format, the OpenXML file format. What I've seen in production is about 50 to 60% reduction in storage savings, or in file size. And what that ends up, what I then tell people is if you want to estimate your storage savings, go with 50%. Right? And your mileage may vary. You may see it's a lot more, a little bit less. But that's one good thing about our OMPM tool, is you can scan all your documents and figure out, hey, can it be cost justified to do my conversion? I'm going to save 784 gigs worth of storage on my network. That's a lot. And depending on the size of your environment, that may be a huge number. Or that may not be much of it all. Especially if you're in an IT environment where you're doing a chargeback model for storage, then you can really quantify. Not just can you say, I can save 784 gigabytes, but hey, business, I can save you $150,000 a year in recurring storage costs. Well, hey, that's something I want to engage in. Or if they're like a 50,000-person company, like, peanuts. but that's where OMPM can be used. Is you can use it to identify low-risk files or files that have a low risk of conversion issues and convert just those. And the tool set can figure out, hey, is this really worth it at all? Right? So you can scan all your stuff, figure out, is it worth it, and then make the decision, yes or no, I will convert, I won't convert, because you have the data to justify that decision. Oh, and one other thing is, if your goal is to save storage savings, maybe you want to think about an archival approach, right? If you have office documents out there that are 3, 4, 5, 10 years old, if your goal is to reduce your storage savings, can you move those files to lower cost storage? Right? I'm not much of an archival storage guy, whatever the modern term is for backing up the tape. But if you can move things to a lower cost storage and get those a lot of files off your high cost storage, that may be the same as doing a document conversion effort with lower risk. And again, conversion is not the goal of deployment. Please separate the two. If you try and convert files during a deployment, you're going to be sad. What that will do, the biggest risk of converting documents during a deployment is you may end up with broken links. Right? So if one file links to another file and you convert that other file, now you've changed the file extension. In a sense, the file name, now you've broken a link. Right? One time, not a big deal. 1,000 times, 100,000 times, that's a significant big deal. Your help desk going to get flooded with calls. Just not worth it. After you guys deploy, then figure out, hey, now do I want to convert? So using the OMPM tool, again, what you can do is you can identify which files are really low risk. And there's a couple criteria I put up here. So OMPM identifies red, yellow, green, and actually no issues, oh, and macro issues, so I guess 5 categories. You can say, I only want to target files that have green issues, or in my opinion, so what issues, or files that have identified as no conversion issues. Those are the files that are my low-risk files. Also, files that have no macro issues identified. And the other criteria is files that haven't been used in the last, or modified in the last, like 30 days, or whatever that number is comfortable. The reason you don't want to convert recently used stuff is because those files may appear on people's most recently used lists. So if you go to File Recent, you're going to see, here's all the stuff I've used recently. If you convert one of those files, then when they click on a recent file, it's broken. Right? And they would say, oh, where'd my stuff go? Help desk call. If you have an outsourced IT or help desk, you can quantify the cost of one help desk call. Again, scale that up in the thousands. That could be pretty significant. So don't convert all that stuff. And using the OMPM tool, let's see. Here is a screenshot of a filter. So this SQL query, and there's a blog site at the end of this presentation that lists in a lot more detail how to do all this stuff. Basically, creating a filter is just like writing a SQL where clause. And what you can do, and what I've done in this case, this is my criteria, that is my low risk criteria. 79% of my files in my environment are low risk. And now I can figure out, hey, what's the storage savings of those 79% of files, and is it worth it to convert all that? Maybe, maybe not. But you have the data to make that decision. Whoops, wrong way. So, let's see. All right, so this is just a how to do bulk conversion. Again, I've got a blog site there that says there's a three-part series, because I wanted to be very explicit, but it wouldn't fit on one. Well, it shouldn't have fit on one blog, so I made it three parts. I've had to do all this stuff. The biggest concern is, I think, the steps. Okay, step 7 and 9 there. When you do a bulk conversion, it is the same as doing bulk save as. To convert a file using the Office Conversion Tool creates an additional copy of the file, right? Just like doing save as. You're not converting the file in place. You're creating a new file. So if your goal is to reduce your storage costs, if you convert 1,000 files using our tool, you will actually create an additional 1,000 files. So you need to identify storage that's going to hold, that's big enough to hold those additional files, and then do some type of cleanup. Right? Our OFC tool will not convert the files in place. There's no switch for that. Right? It's a very safe tool. So what you need to do is that you can facilitate that last step with some type of automation to help move the files back and delete the old ones. Right? And so what I've just said is delete files. That can be risky. So consider that when you're trying to engage in a document conversion project. And there's a lot more detail on that blog site. So what's next? All right, we're getting to the end. This is great. All right, macros. We haven't talked about macros at all. In general, end users don't see macros. Right? Macro is part of a document. They see documents. Is it important to me? Is it not? Usually macros surface as buttons. I have a document with a button, because buttons are usually the front end for your macros. So you can run a tool to identify, do you have any deprecated code in your macros? Deprecated code, updating your deprecated code is a post-deployment task because it helps you optimize your environment or optimize your macro. Because if you have code that has been marked as deprecated from previous versions of Office, what that means in Office terms is it will still compile in Office 2010 and it will still work. What it means is it might not work in future versions of Office. Right? Might not in future. There is one exception to that. If you use the file search method, that is marked as a deprecated item, but it will not work in Office 2010. The Windows search is the functionality that has replaced that. So there's no need to proactively fix any code that's been marked as deprecated. That's a big waste of time. However, if you want to position your solutions to be future-proof, then you can say, hey, listen, this is really important to me. So after I deploy, now I can run a tool to figure out, hey, is there stuff that I may want to update? Right? And that's how you can position all your macros and your future stuff. We have tools, OMPM and OCCI, the Office Code Compatibility Inspector, that will help you identify, do I have macro issues? The challenge there with using those tools is that it doesn't really help you identify, well, are these issues impactful? In fact, OMPM is terrible at that. If you have, a 200-line macro, a document containing a macro that has 200 lines, and you find 12 issues, OMPM will say you have 12 issues. That information by itself is worthless because it will not tell you, well, how impactful are those issues? In general, there are three types of issues in macros that our tools can scan for: deprecated items, removed items, and changed items. Deprecated items consist of about 90% of the things you're going to find. Totally not impactful. Changed items mostly are not impactful because usually it's a change, the syntax changes, and now you have, in most cases, the additional optional parameters. But if you're programmatically using the open method in Excel 2003, there's one required parameter, which is the file name you want to open, and I think 4 or 5 optional parameters. When Office 2010, there's one required parameter, the file name, and 6 or 7 optional parameters. Additional optional parameters in the new object model have no impact in your code. So most change items are not impactful at all. Removed items, yes, they're impactful. So also there's a blog site, and this is all on the Office IT Pro blog. There's a bigger link at the end because I don't expect you to see that. Basically, this is a summary of all the different object model items and issues in all versions of Office going back to Office 2000 of Word, Excel, PowerPoint, Outlook, and Access. Right? So 5 applications, 2000, 2000, XP, 2003, 4 versions. Right? There is over 20,000 object model items in total. Right? That's a big, scary number. there are over 2,000 changes from previous, just in those five applications. I didn't do the other ones. Just in those five applications going back four versions, over 2,000 changes. Well over 90%, 95%, over 1,900 have no impact at all in existing code. Right? So if you use a tool to say, let me find my issues, most of the stuff you're going to get back is going to be noise, not going to be helpful. There are a total, and that's the yellow bar. The red bar is all the impactful items. There are about 50 impactful object model changes in previous versions of Office. Right? So that blog article provides a one-pager. You say, here's a little desk reference. If you have these things, they're impactful, right? There is no deprecated items that are impactful except for file search. Most changed items, I think it's 98% of changed items are not impactful. And then there are some, or no, all removed items. But the total number of that is 50. So it went from 2,000 to 50. So that's 2.5% of the object model items that the tools will find are actually impactful. 2.5%. Anyway, so there's a blog site to get more details about what that really is. But the goal here is don't over-rely on a tool to tell you, is something broken? You can't run a tool and say, does my macro work? And that's some of the key takeaways. First thing is, again, partner with your business areas to do your discovery. Right? Make sure it's start with a user-centric approach. Use business unit delegates or IT relationship managers or business liaisons, whatever you guys, whatever the title is, to say, hey, listen, what does it take to run your business? What Office solutions are out there? You can say, what's in your disaster recovery plan? A great way to shortcut the conversation of, well, what's really critical? Is it in your disaster recovery plan? Make sure you're separating your activities, pre-deployment and post-deployment. Your pre-deployment tasks are deployment enablers, things that are on the critical path to getting you ready to deploy Office 2010. Post-deployment tasks are environment optimization tasks, things that can get value out of your environment, position you for the future, document conversion, updating your macros with deprecated code, environment optimization. And then, oh yeah, prepare your safety net. That's huge. Having something, having your safety net in place, having your mitigation already available before you start to deploy is going to make the conversation a lot easier. It's really easy to say, listen, most stuff is going to work. Trust me. I don't really trust you. But if there's any problems, here's our solution. Oh, that makes me feel better. And that conversation is going to go a lot better with your business partners. And the last item there. Lead in any compatibility project, right? Office, Windows, IE, lead with the process. Right? Don't start with what tools are out there. Lead with process support with tools. Tools provide data. Right? Tools answer technical questions, not business questions. A tool will tell you, does my file have charts? How many macros do I have? How many add-ins are out there? They won't tell you, does my chart look right? Does my macro produce the right results? Is this add-in important? Right? So tools support the process. And that's something to keep in mind. And again, this continues, these takeaways continue for future versions of Office. And this can almost be done regardless of platform you're migrating to. They're just concepts. But for Office, especially the discovery, because the volume of stuff you've got, it's really, really important. All right, so if you are interested in what we talked about, or even if you're not interested, there's a couple related sessions I want to highlight. OSP 303, that's tomorrow at noon. And OSP 34, that's the supporting Office. So if you run into problems, one of our guys on our support team is going to be here talking about that tomorrow. And then there's Office deployment, right? Compatibility is enabling your deployment, making sure you're doing the right stuff to make sure you can deploy smoothly. Well, Richard Smith, one of our deployment experts from the UK, he's leading a session tomorrow about Office deployment. So those are both tomorrow. The first one's at noon, and the deployment session's at 4:30. I strongly recommend you go to those. Those are going to be great. And lastly, here are some other references. The ones at the bottom are the kind of things I referenced earlier. The Office IT Pro blog, it used to be called the Resource Kit blog, I post there frequently. And there's stuff about, hey, what's the right use of OMPM? How do you do bulk conversion? How do you estimate your storage savings? And then there's macro issues. Are these macro issues really impactful or not? And that's it. So please, there's some other resources, all this great stuff. So again, please fill out your evaluations. I have exactly 1 minute left, so thank you so much for your time. And if you have any questions, please feel free to come up and talk. Thanks again, guys.